Well, today we're going to talk about the analytical engine. We've already got footage in the can, as it were, about the principal people involved in this, Charles Babbage, Ada Lovelace. The important thing now, I think, is to just give you the most general overview about how this analytical engine would have worked if only it had ever been built. At the Ada Lovelace Symposium, December 2015, 200th anniversary of her birth, I actually met up with Stephen Wolfram of Wolfram and Mathematica fame, who's done a very good blog on Ada Lovelace, computer programmer. There's also, you'll see it in the info block again, a link to all the lectures given at that 200th anniversary symposium. Last but not least, and it relates to this picture we're using here, one of the lectures there was by Sidney Padua, who was a very, very talented graphic artist. She turned her attention to actually researching the Babbage Lovelace story and has done the whole thing in a hilarious comic book. She envisages, as you see here, Lovelace as this impossible detached heroine but fearfully bright, Babbage's faithful assistant. Here's Charles Babbage, short-tempered, thin-skinned, exactly like the real Babbage. But thanks to Sidney, we're able to actually have a picture here that I can talk to of what the analytical engine will have to look like should it ever be built. It may get built, but it'll be years, it'll be decades before it's ever built, because one has to understand all of Babbage's notation in his technical drawings, and that's no mean feat. Anyway, Sidney has decoded enough of what must happen. Here it is. It's fantastic. This is the analytical engine, as it would have been. I'll try and interpret this for you in modern terms. This sort of almost amphitheatre thing at the end here, that's the CPU. This is, as it were, your Intel chip at the end of this thing. The whole corridor-looking thing of stuff behind her with a proud Babbage standing beside it, that's the memory. And if you look more carefully at this, you'll find that the memory consists of thousands of positions, each of which can hold a 50 decimal digit number. Binary had not occurred to mathematicians even in the early 19th century. In saying that, I do know that the mathematician Leibniz was aware of it. But you can see that even if Babbage had been aware of it, actually the temptation would be stick to what you know. We're here to do generalised arithmetic, and we all know and understand decimal. So yes, it's a decimal machine, 50 decimal places. Every time you want one of these numbers, there's an elaborate mechanical way to fetch it into the CPU. And just look at the CPU itself. If it has got to store these numbers temporarily before it adds them or something like that, then yes, you've got to have yet more of these 50-digit columns inside here to hold the numbers that are in the process of being processed. Roughly speaking, this memory for the machine as designed was 7 meters long, and the whole thing is 3 meters high. It's the most enormous thing. Could you drive this with a handle by hand? Not a chance. Little picture here that Sidney's put in of a steam engine. Babbage was going to drive the whole thing by steam. For those of you who aren't perhaps up with the history of these things, please remember, this is the 1830s and 1840s. Faraday's work on electromagnetism was just about getting underway. But any idea of having electric motors and mains electricity to drive this thing, not till at least the end of the 19th century, turn of the 20th, when this kind of thing will become possible. So yeah, you wanted to drive this thing, the only option would have been steam. Way beyond even a gang of humans to turn all these cogs. So, number one, it says here, the store. Do remember that in English notation for computers, even as late as the 40s and 50s, we in the UK used to call it store. In the US, it was always called memory on IBM machines. American usage has become universal. We now call that memory. Equally, very early papers on computing in the UK, certainly Babbage, this CPU he called the mill, because you put the numbers in and you mill them around and you add them and you subtract them and whatever, they get, you know, roughed up and knocked into an answer. It was called the mill. So that's the only bit of translation you really need. So where's the program stored? Is that stored in this memory here? No, it isn't. The idea was that the cards that drove this thing would be based on well-established and very reliable Jacquard loom technology. Jacquard looms weave lace, and they are programmed to get the right pattern in the lace by having a set of cards that go over sensing rods, and the sensing rods basically, every time they sense a hole, do a stitch at that position, roughly speaking. So by putting different hole patterns on different cards and having a succession of cards, just like a succession of instructions in a program, you could get a beautiful pattern to appear on your lace machine. And there were even card punches available for preparing Jacquard cards, which I think are roughly about 30 centimetres long, something like that. So this was not a flight of fantasy. This was building on existing technology. You can go to a Jacquard Lace Museum in Macclesfield here in the UK. You can see all of this in action. You might say, well, how do you keep the sequence then of the programme instructions on the cards? You sequence them by tying your Jacquard cards together with binding cords down the sides. When you go onto the next card, you don't have to feed it in separately. It's pulled along in by the cords that bind the sides of all the cards together. This most amazing machine was Turing complete. Now, I've done a video on Turing complete, and what's the requirements to be Turing complete? Number one, you've got to be able to have arbitrary amount of memory. Well, in principle, on this you could. Number two, you've got to have a conditional branch statement. You've got to say, if this piece of data is this, then do that, else do this. Two possible routes through your program. Amazingly, Babbage's analytical engine has got if statements built into it. And going along with that, whichever way you go on the if statement, might need you to do, as it were, a go-to, to a different instruction. It was all done on these cards. If you wanted to go to an instruction 10 ahead, then the machine had to arrange to just slip 10 cards on. Boom, 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 boom. You could count to 10. And then, ding, up would come the sensor rods on the 11th card. You've done your jump. And as part of being able to do a jump, why can't you jump back earlier? In other words, do a loop. Yes, of course, if you can do if statements, you can jump backwards, you can do loops. And this could and did do loops as well. Was he a complete genius? Did he realise what he was doing? Or did he just accidentally do the right thing? But this is the thing, remember, the programme is not stored in the same place as the data, as it would be on a modern von Neumann computer. They're both in RAM. I mean, great steps are taken to protect your programme RAM from being overwritten once it's known that that's where the programme is. But in principle, they both sit in the same technology. Whereas here, it was moving about with your cards and shuffling them backwards and forwards that caused the jumps and the loops. So, what else did this have? Well, it did have the ability to store numbers anywhere in memory. So there was a crude addressing system of sorts. It did have the ability to read in a number off so-called number cards. So if you were to say, let's add 3 plus 5, where are the 3 and the 5 going to come from? Well, the easy answer would be get them from number cards. So you'd put an instruction here in your program saying, read next number card. And the number cards here, which are at number 7, you would read in and you say, oh, that's interesting, that's a 3. And you could then either keep it in the CPU and read in the next card, or if you wanted to, optionally, you could store the 3 and the 5 in memory. Now, if you decided to store them and keep them for later, the most amazing thing had to happen was that you had to take a copy of what is in the column here representing number 3 and transfer it to the place in store where you want to hold it. In other words, it's the data bus, stuff being pulled in and pushed back out. And in typical Victorian style, it's not called the data bus, it's called the ingress axis and the egress axis. Now, the ingress axis was for reading stuff in from store memory, and the egress axis was for storing it back out again. But my mouth dropped open. I mean, how is that mechanically done? And the answer is with racks and pinions like you've never dreamed of in your worst nightmares, because this is 7 metres long and the only bit of vacant memory is down at the far end. You've got to transfer the number 3 7 metres down to be stored. So you can just imagine these cogs and racks going like mad and transferring the 3 down to the far end. But you could. You could store the 3, you could store the 5 if you want to. But you would retain copies in the CPU and you would add them together. The addition was done by the barrel controllers here. That's part of the CPU and corresponds very closely to what's sometimes called the microprogramming level inside a CPU. Again, for those of you who know about the era when CPUs were really like computers within computers, they were easier to program that way rather than doing hardcore, close to the metal logic. It used to have the ability to be able to write a program within a program as to how to do an addition within the CPU. Now that is the basis on which this is done. There are sets of barrels with pegs coming out of them, which if they rotate around in the right way and read the 2 numbers that you've put in, 3 and 5, you call up the addition barrel, which swings around on lots of levers, says I am the addition barrel, reads off the 2 numbers. There's lots of other complex stuff inside there because it's like an arithmetic unit built in there as well. Comes to the conclusion the answer's 8 and then posts the answer back out optionally if that's what the program cards say to do. So it's all kind of functionally complete. There'd be an adder in there, there'd be a thing for doing subtractions and so on. But the operations of it are really very, very well known to us. There were other things in here called variable cards. Those really were to stipulate where things might be stored. You might have a read a number card, but you would then optionally read a variable card to discover which location it's to be stored in if you want to keep a permanent copy. So you can imagine that writing programs for this thing was not just getting the instructions right, but also realizing that sometimes you might need to do what would be called a store operation in assembly level programming. Well, that store operation required you to read yet another card from this stack to find out where to store it. During the era where he was in charge of supervising hand-produced logarithm tables, it was the printing that was always the problem. Typos crept in. People sent in flame notes saying, I bought your 7-figure log tables and there's the following 50 errors. So he always wanted his machines, if ever they got built, to have printers built in at the back. So buried around the back of this, yes, there is a printer that could print out the answer and make a permanent record.
And it's very difficult for a firewall or something to notice this because these are valid HTTP requests, they're just super slow, right? And, you know, maybe I've just got a really bad internet.
At the same time, we know that they're actually particles because we never have half a photon, we never have half an electron. So the question is, if each time we send only one electron through these slits, which way does it go?